This is a CBC podcast. Enjoy Canada's opera, pop, jazz, and rock, all recorded live by CBC Radio. The Concerts On Demand website is your source for the best in Canadian concerts. Head to cbc.ca/radio2 and follow the link to Concerts On Demand.
From the Regent Theatre in Picton, Ontario, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The rolling green fields and charming villages of Ontario's Prince Edward County are among the most reassuring places in Canada. You feel safe here, or I do, safely separated from the fretting world by three bridges and a ferry. You got the feeling if things got really bad on the mainland, someone would haul up the bridges and lash up the ferry, and everything here would carry on undisturbed until things were back on track and the bridges could be lowered again. Prince Edward County is halfway between Montreal and Toronto at the eastern end of Lake Ontario. And that means if you live here, you live close enough to either of those cities that you could easily drive to either one in an afternoon. Although why anyone would want to do that is beyond me. And it seems to most people who live on this bucolic island. I've been here for less than a week, and I'm beginning to feel that way myself. Of course, that's the last thing you want to hear. Another jerk from Toronto with a gleam in his eye, hanging around the real estate office. I arrived on Tuesday night. I arrived planning to talk about your country's rich agricultural heritage. Pick an era, any era, and these island fields have stories to tell. The barley days, the shipping days, the canning days, and these days. All the little vineyards and cheesemakers and organic farmers that have been springing up and attracting tourists. I thought I was coming here to talk about the land. But on Tuesday, when we pulled into Picton, the largest of the county's three communities, I turned onto Main Street and my plans shifted. Over the past few years, I've traveled from one end of this country to the other, from east to west and west to east, and to the north, too, all the way to the Beaufort Sea and back. And in my travels, I have visited all the cities and a lot of the little towns and villages, hundreds for sure. I've filled notebooks with the things that I have seen, hundreds of those, too. And one of the things I have seen as I've traveled around is the sad state of so many of our main streets. Our propensity for the automobile, the convenience of the shopping mall, the economies of the box store, and the temptations of the internet have, in so many places, laid waste to the little cafes and corner shops of our past. I have seen too many towns with too many boarded up storefronts. And that is why I was so delighted to turn off Highway 49 onto your main street. It made me happy. You have one of the most pleasing little main streets in the country. So pleasing that I decided I would forgo the fields and stay in town to see what was different here and if something was, if I could understand why it was. I woke up early on Wednesday and I spent the day dropping in and out of stores and chatting with storekeepers and the people they were serving. And I saw all sorts of little Main Street moments that told me something was happening. Let's begin with a bookstore. Or maybe with a ginger tabby cat that greeted me when I walked into the bookstore. Down the street at Stedman's, where you can buy everything from a funnel to a foam mattress, I watched a clerk carry a package halfway down the block and place it carefully in the trunk of someone's car. There are 9, and you can count them tomorrow yourself, 9 pairs of glasses lined up in the window of the Picton Gazette this week. Right beside the box of orphan keys. The Gazette's where everyone brings things lost and found, and what is lost and found more than glasses? The paper prints a notice and then leaves lost items in the window where they can be seen. Speaking of things lost, I wandered into Richard Davis's menswear on Wednesday when pretty much every other store on Main Street was closed for the day. Robin Everhardest was still standing behind the till. She pointed at a black purse on the counter when I asked her why she was still open. "Someone forgot that here this afternoon," she said. "I figure they're going to panic and come back looking for it. I'm going to wait for another hour or so just in case they show up." I can say with certainty that wouldn't happen where I come from. Hasn't always been so here. Just 15 years ago, more than one of the buildings on Main Street were empty, some of them so empty that snow blew down the hallways in the winter. Many small towns have snow blowing down their main streets these days. Before I got here to Picton, I always blamed the malls and the so-called convenience alleys that surround them like little encampments. And no doubt that's a major piece of the puzzle. But this week, talking to you, I learned it's only part of it. I've learned a lot this week. I've learned Picton has reinvented itself more than once. And I have learned some of the things that you are doing and have done that have helped in this most recent reinvention. First off, you've been lucky. You can't deny that. With a population of about 4,000, you were small and, forgive me, insignificant enough to have been ignored by the Walmarts of the world. The Walmarts of the world weren't looking at you when they were busy looking for the next place to build an outlet. And sure, there are a few big stores on the outskirts of your town, a Canadian Tire and a car dealership, but there isn't a power aisle sucking you out of town, or not so far. I've learned that geography has been helpful, too. You live on an island, and more than one person has told me they don't like crossing the bridge. And that means a lot of you think twice before you leave the county to shop in Belleville or Kingston. And that means there's still a shoe store on Main Street and more than one place to buy menswear and the bookstore and you know. The land is productive here. I've learned that these days the land is once again attracting new people, and with new people come new ideas and new ways of doing things, new money. And yes, new problems too. So you have been lucky, lucky with the land and scale and geography. But it hasn't only been luck. You've also been smart, really smart. Whose idea was it to put the beer store at one end of Main Street and the liquor store at the other? Now that was brilliant. And I know it drives you batty in the summer, especially when you're stuck behind some come from away like me who's trying to figure out what he's supposed to do at the top of Town Hill. But you got to admit it, the liquor store thing works. Is there anything else that would bring you onto Main Street on a summer day? Well, yes, there is. The post office is on Main Street. And when Canada Post offered to build community post boxes and place them conveniently close to your houses so you didn't have to come downtown, you nearly lost your collective mind. You went eyeball to eyeball with Canada Post and they blinked. The post office is another reason that Main Street is alive and well. And the library. And now that you have a main street that is vibrant and working, developers are looking at some of the old buildings, the old hotels, and the old three-story storefronts, and they're putting money into them and renovating them and building apartments, good apartments, with washers and dryers and elevators up to the second and third floors. And that means people will be living on Main Street. And we all know there is nothing like people living in a downtown core to keep it alive, and that is as true of a small town as it is of a big city. Sure, you are lucky, but you are smart, too. I don't want to give anyone listening the idea I think it's perfect here. There's plenty of disagreement here. The wineries that are coming are bringing in money, but not everyone who lives here can keep pace with that, or want to, or agree with big cottage developments and windmill farms. It's not perfect here, but it's not perfect anywhere. The thing is, Main Street is working, and that's as close to perfect as you can get these days. There is stuff here you want to buy, and you can buy it from someone you know, someone who actually owns the store. Your money stays in the local economy. You bump into your friends and neighbors when you shop, and when you do, you can go for a coffee and talk about those windmills. These are the things that I've learned from you and your wonderful Main Street. And I just wanted to tell you, I guess, that I think it's important, and I think you guys are doing a good job. One last thing. I was talking to bookstore owner Alexandra Bake. As you know, her father came here from Holland. Alexandra was telling me those Dutch people knew all this stuff years ago. Main Streets are important in Holland, too, because they want to be able to ride their bikes to the stores. And Alexandra told me if a company wants to build a big box store on the outskirts of a Dutch town, they have to build a little satellite store on the main street. Now that's a good idea. That's a great idea, an idea plenty of city councils could adopt across this country. You heard it here first. Please pass it on. And if anyone asks, tell them you heard it in Picton. Thank you. Thank you. It's time to get to the music part of the show now. I first heard of our guests today a couple of years ago. They were only teenagers at the time, young teenagers, barely teenagers actually, only about 13 or 14 years old. Their dad, Brian, sent us a CD of their music. I finally caught up with them this year at the Hillside Music Festival in Guelph. They were playing under a big tent that night, singing around one microphone, dressed in suits and ties, and before long, everyone was up on their feet dancing, yours truly included. And I knew right then and there that I wanted to have them on the Vinyl Cafe. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome from Kingston, Ontario, the Abrams Brothers.
I was born with a hammer. John Hammer knew my name, cause I was born with a hammer in my hand. The boss man tries to break a good man's spine. He takes dirt him in a lane, miles a track. The neighbors say, girls, a line, let me 30 miles behind me. I was born with a hammer in my hand. John Henry was a steel-driving man. You could hear his hammer ring across the land. But they put us off our side, he'd have to run and hide, cause I was born with a hammer in my hand.
Yes, I'm born with a hammer in my hand.
The Abrams Brothers. So which is the dad? Which is Brian? Okay, can you introduce the kids?
I sure can. On the right-hand side here, on your left, is our 15-year-old son who's been playing the fiddle since he was six. That's James Abrams.
Thank you.
And on the left-hand side here, playing the upright bass, is my nephew. He's 18 years of age, Mr. Elijah Abrams. The fellow who just sat down at the piano at the back, his name is Chris Brown, and I won't tell you his age. On the old five-string banjo, that's Mr. Glenn McDonald. Yep. And the young man doing the singing on that first cut was our 18-year-old son, our oldest son, Mr. John Abrams.
And how did this all begin?
Well, it really started back in the 1940s with my grandparents, Ray and Leela Abrams. They started playing gospel music in the Kingston area and traveled with tent shows and revival meetings and camp meetings. And along came my father, who played with them for many, many years. And then I was born, and my mom and dad had a band that included my grandparents and my parents and my brother and I, Eli's father. And then many years later, the boys came along and started playing the fiddles. And at one point in time, we had three generations playing on the stage, my dad and myself and the boys. And then Grandpa Wayne, he stepped aside to let his grandson Eli play the bass. And so here we are today as the Abrams Brothers.
So why don't you do another number now? And why don't you see if you can put a little more energy into this one?
Okay, I think we'll do one off the brand new album, Blue on Brown's, called the Nashville Skyline Rag Boys.
Thank you.
Those were the Abrams Brothers, and that's off their album, Blue on Brown. We're going to get them back in a few moments, but first, it's time for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, and they have to be short, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. It's up to you. We'll read everything you send us, and we'll read some of our favorites on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we'll send you a copy of our brand new Vinyl Cafe CD. It's called Vinyl Cafe Storyland. Today's story comes to us from John Dryden of Duncan, British Columbia. Dear Stuart, writes John, I noticed the turtle instantly. It was about 20 meters away from me, but I knew it was a turtle the moment I saw it. It was a small green thing scuttling across our lawn. Hey, look, I hollered at my wife and kids. There's a turtle on the front lawn. I ran inside to get a box and a video camera. I called the Salt Spring Island Wildlife Association. They asked me if the turtle looked hurt. I told them that the turtle looked very healthy. The Wildlife Association suggested we find a pond and set the turtle free. So off we set. My wife, our three kids, and the turtle, all in the family van. We drove to the closest pond. The turtle was very still the entire ride. It kept its head close to its shell. When we arrived at the pond, we placed the box on the bank of the pond and gently tipped it over. The turtle moved incredibly fast. It lunged into the water, disappearing, then resurfacing in the midst of a group of hovering bugs. We took this as a thank you, as a sort of farewell wave from a happy, saved turtle. It was a great feeling to have worked together as a family and to have improved the life of one of nature's creatures. It was a proud communal moment for our family. I remember Liz saying, "Just think, kids, not everyone can say that they've saved a turtle." It was 4 days later when I saw the poster stapled to the telephone pole. Lost, it said. Treasured family pet. 21-year-old Samantha the turtle. The description of Samantha fit our rescued turtle perfectly. I told my wife, but not my kids, and I resolved to call the number listed on the poster the next day. I hid in the garage when I dialed the number. "Hi," I said to the woman who answered the phone. "I'm calling about the lost turtle. I have good news, and I have bad news. The good news is Samantha is alive." And then I went into my account of the rescue. It was difficult to tell someone that you had their 21-year-old pet and then had set it free in the wild. But Samantha's owner was happy to have any news. She told me she'd go and look for Samantha in the pond. I never found out whether or not she found her. But I did learn from her. I learned how I would respond if something similar happened to me. And I gained new appreciation for those who put up those missing signs. Sometimes any news at all, is good news. That story came to us from John Dryden of Duncan, British Columbia. These are the Abrams Brothers.
Shadows play on the snow. A gently moonlight casts its glow. Close your eyes, stars appear. When you wake, we will be far from here. There's a promise left to keep. I will drive while you sleep. a crack from where you punched it. There's a man. We take on stones, bear our scars, cheating corners, passing cars. The road is winding, sometimes steep, but I will drive while you sleep, while you tomorrow will be nearer. The dawn will break and the road will be much clearer. All our sadness is a rear view mirror. Your eyes go when you're singing to the radio. Sure as tomorrow became today, we can go there, but we can't stay. And there's a promise that I can keep. I will drive, I will drive.
They say that love is blind. We all know they're right. There is no end to the mischief a myopic heart can hatch. No end at all. But you don't have to be love-struck to stir up trouble. Those lesser emotions can be just as dangerous. No one would ever say that Bert Turlington loves Dave. But Bert wouldn't deny that he feels a certain fondness, he might even say affection for his neighbor. It's not love. More maybe the accumulation of feelings that bind people together when they live side by side for many years. The small kindnesses and courtesies of what amounts to an arranged marriage. So you could forgive Bert Turlington his neighborly heart when he blurted out his invitation to Dave that night in the park. You might, but Bert's wife, Mary, didn't. You what? Said Mary. Bert invited Dave and Morley to drive with them to Montreal for Harold Buskirk's 65th birthday. And to stay with us, added Mary, in Renee's house. It just came out, said Bert, unexpectedly. Dave had said something about how he and Morley weren't sure they were going to make it to the party. They hadn't made hotel reservations, and you know. And Bert thought, no, said Mary, don't use that word. You didn't think. There wasn't any thought involved. Harold Buskirk, who used to live up by the park, was turning 65. And pretty much the whole neighborhood was going to Montreal for the party. People had been working on sketches and speeches and songs. And Mary had been working on the cake. But not just any cake, a masterpiece, a Frangelico-soaked chocolate fudge cake with white chocolate icing and an orange buttercream and truffle ganache filling. It was Harold's retirement as well as his birthday, and Mary was going to decorate her cake so it looked like a golf course, complete with little buttercream golf balls and a marzipan foursome standing triumphantly on the ninth tee. Bert and Mary were driving to Montreal. They were staying at Rene Gallivan's house. Rene is Mary's boss. Rene was in Florida or Palm Springs, one of those places. You said it was a mansion, said Bert. I thought there'd be plenty of room. There was that word again. Bert was talking to himself again. Mary had stormed off. They left on Saturday morning, just after lunch. Not that anyone actually ate lunch. They were supposed to leave before lunch and eat on the road, but Mary had a moment with the icing, and there was a last-minute cake flurry, and lunch was lost. But there they were, on the road, 2 p.m. and nearly in Kingston, a mere 2 hours behind schedule. The four of them in Bert's Volvo, the luggage in the trunk, the cake in the cooler, Dave and Morley in the back seat, and Mary in a state. The cooler with the cake was wedged onto the armrest between Dave and Morley. They could barely see each other over the cooler. As they roared past Kingston, Dave said, "There's a great burger joint up ahead. If anyone felt like a no stopping," said Mary. "There's no time for stopping." At Cornwall, Dave, who was completely famished, made a lame joke that if he could eat his cake now. And Mary whirled around and said if Dave as much as breathed on her cake, he could start walking. There's no doubt that Mary was wound up. She was wound up tighter than a 7-day clock. The cake was iced with the green icing, but she still had to add the decorations, and it had to chill after that, and Mary had promised Harold they'd be at the club early to help with the setup. They were 2.5 hours behind schedule when they pulled up in front of Renee's house, the limestone house on Upper Walnut Crescent, a little-known cul-de-sac near the top of Westmount Mountain. "Holy crow," said Dave, as he unfolded himself from the back seat. He was standing on the sidewalk and staring at the huge red oak doors, at the mahogany fluting and the maple rosettes, at the lead-paned windows, at the thick stone walls. "Oh, my," said Mary. They were all standing on the sidewalk now. "Wow," said Bert. "Remember, everyone," said Mary, "we have to leave everything exactly the way we found it." She was staring at Dave. As Dave stepped through the threshold and into the marble foyer, Morley put her arm on his elbow and whispered, "Just don't touch anything." The kitchen turned out to be in the basement, the kind of kitchen where help rather than family worked. It had a fireplace. "Holy crow," said Dave, "you could roast an ox in there." And a walk-in fridge. "Look at this," said Dave. Mary was decorating her cake, sticking little marzipan flags carefully into the center of the little greens. Morley was standing beside her, holding a bowl of brown icing for the sand traps. Bert was wiping the counters. Everyone was tiptoeing around, trying not to disturb a thing, trying not to make a mess. And no one was trying harder than Dave. "I'll take the luggage to the bedrooms," said Dave. Soon enough, the cake was decorated and in the fridge, and everyone was ready to go, though not the cake. The cake had to chill for at least an hour, or better, too. "As long as possible," said Mary. But Mary was already supposed to be at the party. Dave said, "You guys should go." Dave said, "I'll stay and bring the cake when it's ready." Now, what's so funny about that? Morley wrote down the address of the banquet hall for Dave so he could take a taxi. And then Morley and Bert and Mary left in Bert's car. Once they were gone, Dave set off to see if he could find something to eat. It was while he was looking for anything even remotely edible that Dave found the most amazing feature of the mansion, a wood-paneled elevator, the kind you might see in an old British hotel, about the size of a phone booth. He opened what he thought was a cupboard door, and there it was. It had brass fittings and a brass needle over the door to show you where you were. He would have taken a ride, but he didn't have time to waste. They were waiting for him at the hall. He went downstairs and fetched the cake from the cooler. It was touching, the greens and the flags and the buttercream shrubs all around the circumference. He carried it carefully over to the counter. He wasn't going to mess this up. Okay, he had everything. Wait a minute. No, he didn't. The address for the party was upstairs in the bedroom. He started up the stairs, and then he stopped dead. He shouldn't leave the cake unattended. The house was so vast, there might be dogs or cats or any number of things roaming around that could get into it. He went back down the stairs and fetched the cake and started up again. Four floors. Wait a minute. The elevator. He should take the elevator. The elevator would be safer. He went in backwards. The brass door accordioned behind him. It was like stepping back in time to a dimmer time, a time before electricity. He stood there in the dimness, the cake safely beside him on the floor. He grabbed the elevator handle and plunged it to the right. There was a bang and a shudder and a sudden lurch, and the elevator started to move. He could almost feel the chains hauling him up, as if there were two or three men at the top of this elevator, and not strong men either, huffing and puffing as they turned some rusty crank. Come on, said Dave. The elevator was moving, but it was moving in small, jerky increments. The shaft seemed to be too loose for the car. There was a lot of wobble. And then there was no wobble at all. There was nothing. Absolutely nothing. Are we moving? Said Dave. They weren't moving. They being Dave and the cake. Not up, that is. But that didn't mean there was no movement. There was still plenty of movement. The little car felt like it was swinging back and forth, like a bucket on the end of a rope. Hello? Anybody? I'm trapped in the elevator. He took a deep breath. He reached out and put his hand on the door handle. He opened the elevator door. He was staring at a wall of plaster. There was a big number 3 written on the plaster in red chalk. He sat in the corner of the elevator, his head in his arms. He realized he could die in there. But really, what did that matter? If he didn't get the cake to the hall on time, Mary would kill him anyway. An hour went by. Shouldn't he be here by now? Said Mary to Bert. He'll be here, said Bert, with more hope than conviction. He's probably sitting in a taxi right now with the cake in his lap. Bert was half right. Dave had the cake in his lap. But he wasn't sitting in a taxi. He was sitting in the elevator, and he'd eaten every second shrub. Half an hour later, the little golf course had shrunk from 9 to 7 holes. And the marzipan foursome was a twosome. And Dave was sitting there eyeing the little golf cart. And that's when he spotted the emergency phone. It didn't fill him with hope. There was no dial. It was covered in dust. He picked it up and brought it to his ear. The other end of that phone, and therefore Dave's only salvation that night, was in the hands of a university student. The student, a weekend employee, was beginning his second overnight shift. And he was stretched across 3 office chairs in front of the surveillance panel so deeply asleep that he wasn't only snoring, He was drooling. The student had been trained the night before by the woman who had had the shift before him. She'd been in a hurry to leave. His training had lasted less than 15 minutes. She showed him the computer and the surveillance panel, but she didn't say anything about any phones. So when a phone began to ring, it took him by complete surprise. He sat up with a jerk and looked around. He was so dopey with sleep, he couldn't figure where the ringing was coming from. When he finally opened the cupboard on the other side of the room, you could have knocked him over with a feather. There wasn't a phone in there. There were 50 phones in there. All of them attached to the wall, all of them red, all of them missing their dials. They looked like the kind of phones you might use to launch a missile strike. There were so many phones that it was impossible to tell which one was ringing. The student started picking the phones up at random. Before he found the right one, the ringing stopped. It took him a while to get back to sleep after that. About an hour passed before the phone rang again. This time the student ran to the cupboard right away. This time he got the right phone on the fifth ring. "Hello," he said. Dave was as surprised as he was to find someone on the other end of the line. Dave said, "I'm stuck in the elevator." Then, just to be sure the kid understood the severity of his situation, he added, "With Mary's cake." "What?" said the student. "I'm in the elevator," said Dave. "Which elevator?" said the student. "How many elevators are there?" said Dave. "I don't know," said the student. "I'm new." Dave explained about the house on the mountain and the cake and the party. "I know where I'm going," said Dave, "but I don't know where I am." The student said, "Is this like a test or something?" Dave said, "This is real. You've got to send somebody to help me." And the student said, "I can't send help if I don't know where you are. I'll get fined. Call me back when you know where you are." And he hung up. Dave stood in his elevator staring at the handset in disbelief. He was so hungry he could barely think straight. Desperate times require desperate measures. He slid the cake so it was half off the plate and stood up and held it very carefully over his head. He began to nibble at the bottom of the cake. Then he stuck his right hand right into the cake and pulled out a fistful of the chocolate ganache. Mary would never know. He sat on the floor licking the icing off his fingers. He picked up the phone again. It rang 10 times. "Hello? It's me," said Dave. "Me too," said the kid. "Listen, I'm sorry I hung up," said the kid. "I'm a little scared." "Me too," said Dave. "What are you scared of?" "I'm scared I might get fired if you die. Do you think I'd have to put it on my resume?" It took them half an hour to figure it out. There was a number on the phone, number 52. They were talking on phone number 52. All the other phones had different numbers. The kid found a binder with a legend, an address that corresponded to each phone number. "You're on Upper Walnut Crescent," said the kid. Back at the hotel, Mary was beside herself. The main course had been served, and there was still no sign of Dave. Bert said, "I'll go. I'm sure everything's fine. I'll go and check." He wasn't really sure. Mary stared at him. Mary said, "You stay here." Mary's taxi pulled up in front of the Gallivan's house 15 minutes after the fire trucks. So Mary missed the part where they drove the axe through the red oak front doors. But she was there when the elevator doors opened to see Dave huddled over her cake like a raccoon huddled over a garbage can. His hands and face were covered in icing. He'd been trying to smooth out the cake surface with his fingers. When Dave saw Mary, he stood up and held the cake out at her and smiled like a child handing in a class project. Safe and sound, he said. They both stared at the cake without saying a word. And as they did, the lone marzipan golfer standing by what was now the sixth and final hole started to sink slowly. First to his knees, and then to his waist, as the entire cake began to collapse into itself as if it was built on a giant sinkhole. Neither of them said anything on the long drive back to the party, although at Dave's suggestion, they stopped at an all-night grocery store and bought a replacement cake, the only cake left in the store, a My Little Pony birthday cake. The drive home the next day was even quieter, as was the rest of the autumn, the first time there was ever a noticeable strain between the neighbors. Not actual unpleasantness, just a determined quiet, which was unpleasant enough in itself. And then one night, seemingly out of the blue, Bert called and invited Dave and Morley for dinner. They couldn't have picked a worse night. It was Dave's birthday. Dave and Morley had reservations at a little Italian place they favor. Cancel them, said Morley. And so they went next door. And dinner was not unpleasant, though it was awkward. Mary seemed to be trying hard to let bygones be bygones, but you could tell it was a strain. And then it was time for dessert. And Mary went into the kitchen and came back with a birthday cake. A My Little Pony birthday cake. She carried it to the table and she set it down in front of her, and then she blew out the candles herself. And then she picked it up and very carefully turned it over and scooped out a handful from the bottom of the cake and plopped it on Dave's plate. Mary said, "That's the way you like it, right?" Dave sat there staring at his plate, not knowing what he should do, looking back and forth between Mary and his wife. It was Morley who started to giggle. Morley giggled, Mary smiled, and Bert started laughing so hard he was pounding the table. They all laughed. They all laughed and laughed. Call them friends. Call them neighbors. Call it fondness or call it affection. Call it love if you want to. It's really the only choice. You fight or you swallow your pride and you laugh. And that's what they did. They laughed. It's what good neighbors always do. For today's show, I want to thank our special musical guest, the Abrams Brothers. Yeah. Thanks also this week to Frank Finistori, Bill Herault, and Brad Scrutton for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Ron Skinner is the recording engineer. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean, and we're going to let the Abrams Brothers play us out here. So long for now.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.